Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I did a show with Scott of Loving Life, and it started out actually based on my high-level strategic analysis, but it was modified into being a discussion about the year as a whole. And Scott went in quite a number of different directions. So while it has got similarities, a lot of similarities to my high-level analysis, as the show continues, Scott goes into all kinds of very interesting directions. And this gets very, very interesting with regard to South Africa. We really get into a lot of other detail, and we really discuss some very fascinating things, including secession, failed state, and those kinds of things. It turns into a hell of an interesting discussion, actually.
Goeienaand, good evening, fellow South Africans and citizens of the world, and welcome to tonight's live stream. Well, tonight I'm talking to Jan Lamprecht from History Reviewed, and for those who don't know, he actually has a page on the Loving Life TV forum where we have regular updates and really interesting videos and articles, so do check out our forum. And also, if you're at a loose end over Christmas, go and have a chat on our 24/7 chat on Loving Life TV. Obviously, you have to be registered to use that, but you know, it's a great little place to catch up with people who are part of the Loving Life family. Alrighty, now tonight we're talking to Jan Lamprecht, who we've had on several times, and he's a very, very interesting fellow. As I just mentioned, he's got History Reviewed, and we're going to be talking about the year gone by, and we're talking specifically about some of the big issues that have happened this year, including the war in Ukraine. So without any further ado, I'll get Jan on so we can start our chat. Here we go. Hi, Jan.
Hi there, Scott. How are you?
Excellent, buddy. And how are you?
I'm all right, thanks.
Good.
Operating on battery power since 4 p.m.
Oh,
but,
wow.
We're functioning fine. So brought to you by battery power.
So load shedding's in full swing over there.
Today it seems so. It varies from day to day.
Yeah.
I don't even look at the schedules, because these freaking clowns, you know, they say this and then they do that, and
yeah.
then things fall apart unexpectedly. But that's going to be how it's going to go, and it's going to get worse.
Yeah. Now, mate, can I ask you a little favor? Can you move your camera down just about an inch? I'm losing your chin. That's better.
Okay.
Yeah. That's perfect.
Okay,
that's
cool.
Absolutely perfect. All right, now, Jan, tonight we're going to be basically looking at the year in review, and it's been a very, very disturbing year when you look what's going on around the world at the moment. And probably the biggest thing that happened this year was the war in Ukraine, and Vladimir Putin. He's a very interesting person because of his background. He was so tied up with the KGB, and now he's running the country, and he's got his own oligarchs in there. Do you want to talk to us about Vladimir Putin, and how has your view of Vladimir Putin changed during this year?
Yeah, Putin is a very fascinating guy, and The first time I really took notice of him was when all these photos came out of sort of Vladimir Putin, the He-Man, and he's looking all buffy, and he's been doing gym, and he's looking tough, and he's doing all these manly things, which in the pathetic Western world you're not allowed to do. But Vladimir Putin came across to me, also because of his KGB background, he kind of came across as a kind of a He-Man, a kind of Russian James Bond. And when he came to power, he seemed like a tough guy, a determined guy, etc. But I must tell you that watching Putin and following the Ukraine war this year, my views on Putin have changed quite a bit. And as a result also of this Ukraine war, I assume you saw that at a point the Russians reminded the blacks of South Africa that Russia had been on the side of the fight against apartheid. And also the Russian government sent out a thing to the blacks on Africa Day, reminding them that Russia's always been there to fight against colonialism. And, you know, the thing that astounded me about Putin during the Ukraine war was really to see that there's another side to Putin. And, you know, one of the things that astounded me when the war started was I was wondering if the Russians were going to try to knock out the internet, the Ukrainian internet. And I was also waiting for them to hack and knock out certain things using hackers. But the fact that the internet stayed on, and I was looking at the stuff that was coming out of the internet, and I was saying to myself, you know, a lot of this stuff that's coming out on the internet from the war in Ukraine, I don't see how this is positive for Putin and for the Russians. And I became amazed with time at how comfortable Putin was getting onto TV, getting onto the media, and talking. And I began to start viewing Putin not so much as a general or a commander, but as a propagandist. And that for me has been a big change. I was amazed at how much of Putin's stuff is talking. And also, of course, he can talk all he wants about his military, but at the end of the day, the military's got to perform, and he's been running into lots of problems. But I came away viewing Putin as much more of a propagandist than I could ever have imagined.
Right. Well, look, a couple of things just to pick on what you were saying there. And the first is that I think the only reason the internet is working in Ukraine is because of Elon Musk and his Starlink satellites, which are apparently providing the internet access to Ukraine. I find that quite extraordinary, because Elon Musk, you know, he's certainly not a member of the Democrat Party in the US. And when you consider what he's done with Twitter, where he's basically, you know, taken off all the shackles, and now Donald Trump can have his account back and so on. He's done some remarkable things in opening up freedom of speech. And I was really surprised when he became involved in the war in Ukraine by actually providing Ukraine with that internet facility. What are your thoughts about that?
I actually wasn't aware of him providing their internet. I would have assumed it was just a business deal, but I must tell you that I think that the fact that the internet has been running in Ukraine has been very bad for the Russians.
Yes.
Very bad for them in many, many ways. Not just propaganda. Propaganda, it was already a very bad thing. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that was going on in the war where you had people running drones, doing all kinds of things, and it was running through the internet. And I was looking at this and I was saying, but, you know, these guys, and do you know that there were like hackers and guys in America and elsewhere who were getting onto the internet and helping the Ukrainians use drones and things and spotting Russians and killing Russians. And I was looking at this and I was saying, man, oh man, Putin would be much better off if there's no internet. So it's very interesting that that was an Elon Musk thing. In general, as a side note, Elon Musk has been quite amazing with Twitter and the things he's been involved in, and I've been amazed. I've been quite amazed. I hope that he sticks to his guns. He could actually be the best thing that's happened in 2022.
Yeah. Look, I want to share a screen with you because, we talk about the war in Ukraine and Putin. This screen that I'm sharing with you is of the current situation. This is updated every day. And it looks to me that there's Ukraine. You can see the border of Ukraine running around there. You've got Moldova over here, which is bordering Ukraine on the west. And then, of course, you've got the Crimean annexed part of Russia there. And the part in red here, this is still Ukraine, that's now occupied by Russia. And there are four yes. provinces, or I think they call Osks or something like that. Oblasts, that's it. Which are basically being annexed by Russia. And this blue part up here is the part that's been reclaimed from Russia by Ukraine. And you can see there's a big piece over here that's been reclaimed by Ukraine. Now, the reason this is so intriguing is because they seem to have come to a stalemate. This is how it's been for the last 4 or 5 months. In other words, you've got Russia occupying this east and southern part of Ukraine here, and Ukraine slowly taking bits of it. So it's almost like they've got a stalemate now happening in Ukraine. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think this has really gone badly wrong for Putin?
Yes, I think it's gone very bad for Putin. I was following it intensely, and I think you might recall that early on in the war we spoke about Kiev and some of the things, and I'm sure that I did say to you that as the war progresses it will start slowing down. And you can see that more and more. The biggest event since about May was the retaking of Kharkiv in yes. the northeast. That was a big battle, and I watched that for many weeks on end. And they managed to eventually push them back. And isn't it amazing that the Russians are almost back to where they were at the start of the war? They've got some territory that they didn't have in the beginning. They've got quite a bit of territory that they didn't have in the beginning. But they've been losing flat out since about April. And the most recent thing that they lost was Kherson. And the big takeaway, I think, is that the Ukrainians have been fighting to get their cities back. So they got back Kharkiv, they defeated them in Kiev, and they managed to get even Kherson back. Though Kherson can still be hit by artillery, and the thing about Kherson is it's on a river. And for the Ukrainians to get across that river is going to be a big, big battle. But and remember now, we're in winter, hey? So it's ice, it's freezing, it's the whole winter is going to be very nasty. And normally the war will slow down even more in the winter. We can expect to see things picking up maybe in about April next year. But the war has gone very wrong for Putin. And if you look at the big chunks that he captured within a few days, within 2 weeks, etc., and he had to retreat his whole army out of enormous chunks of it. So, but I will add the final thing. What Putin is doing now is he's brought in a Russian commander who has a certain type of strategy that he uses, and he's used it in the past, and he's used it in a couple of places. And one of the places he used it the most was in Syria. And what this guy does is he rather attacks the civilians. So he hits civilian targets endlessly. He smashes civilian targets endlessly, and that helps his side to kind of hang in there. And if you noticed in the last several weeks, Putin's been firing those cruise missiles, and they're hitting infrastructure all across Ukraine,
yeah.
Knocking out power, destroying this. This is a typical Syria strategy, and the Russians are digging in. Because if it's just the Russians versus the Ukrainian army, the Ukrainians are pretty good. The Ukrainians are very outnumbered, but they are very good with certain of their weapons, especially the artillery, and they were giving the Russians a very hard time, and so it's a real heavy fight. It's a very heavy fight, but the Russians have been battling to move forward, and you'll see that the Russians have, in many places in the east, the Russians have been fighting for places like Bakhmut and stuff, which is nothing more than a tiny little village that's got no value whatsoever, whereas the Ukrainians have been fighting for actual cities. And I'd say getting Kharkiv and getting Kherson was good strategy on their part. I was actually getting quite concerned. They were taking very long to get Kherson. It was a hell of a struggle to get it. But the two sides, it's starting to settle down. But the big thing is whether the West can continue supplying the Ukrainians. And the other side is the Russians can hang in for a long period of time. The Russians must be taking some heavy casualties as well, hey? You know, one thing I haven't heard for months now is I've not heard for months either side guessing or writing up the number of people killed. And it must be running into the tens and tens of thousands. I wouldn't be surprised if anything from 50,000 easily to 100,000, if 100,000 people have died this year, not to mention another 100,000 sitting in wheelchairs and things. I think the casualties in this war have been insane. I don't think there's a war that we've seen possibly since World War II that's been as bad as this thing. This thing is nasty. Maybe the Vietnam War had more casualties, but this thing is nasty.
You know what I found fascinating is the progression of technology. Back when we had the invasion of Iraq by America, we had that shock and awe, and you had embedded reporters actually filming the attack of Baghdad by America live, and you could see that on television. Now with the Ukraine war, I've seen so many videos of drones going in and basically taking out tanks and things like that. So these are unmanned flying bombs, if I can put it that way, but they're actually guided by someone, rather like a drone that you might see in the sky today. And these drones actually go in and they take out a target. But it's a way they can actually film where that drone is going and what it's doing in real time. I mean, the technology is extraordinary. And a lot of this stuff has come from places like Iran. Iran, funny enough, have supplied Russia with most of their drones, which they're using to take out, as you're saying, power supplies and stuff like that. Whereas America are supplying Ukraine with a huge amount of weapons. It's something like $80 billion worth of support they've given so far. Well, what do you think about that? Do you think that this is actually a war between NATO and Russia and not Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, now you're getting into an interesting topic, Scott. Yes, in many ways, this is a war between America and Russia. The Europeans didn't even want in on this. Even NATO didn't want in on this. This is America versus Russia, really, at the end of the day. There's been a whole bunch of American messing around behind the scenes on this. And something else that I discovered was that in recent decades, I think in the last 10 years or so, they discovered huge oil and gas fields that run across Ukraine from about that eastern portion all across the top. And it's interesting that all this fighting in Ukraine has occurred in the time since that oil and gas has been found. And I'm sure there's all kinds of wheeling and dealing and money and things going on. And I also don't think Putin is himself, I don't think he's a little angel from heaven either. I think he's also got some other motives as well. But yeah, I think you're right. It's much more an American versus Russian thing. Something that I had on my old African Crisis website, which I really need to put out as a video, was I published something in 2005. Just making a note here. I published something in 2005 where a Russian general actually wrote and said that there would the Third World War would start round about 2014, and he said it would happen near Russia, that the Americans would expand and they'd come close to Russia, and Russia and America would fight World War III close to Russia. And then he said that China would enter World War III in 2030. I actually need to do a video about it. I've got the original article from 2005.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you say that China will get involved in 2030, because I was speaking to Joel Skarsen about a week ago, and he suggested that World War III will actually start proper in 2027. He actually set the year. He said 2027 is when China will feel that they've got enough military might to take on America as well. Now, if that happens, surely America are completely stuffed, because you've then got both Russia and China fighting against America. And the rest of NATO, let's face it, I mean, they're chicken feed compared to what America can do.
Yeah, America's spent something like 15 times as much on its military as like the whole world combined or something. It's an insane amount. But America's actually extremely militarized. Extremely militarized. And the other thing about the Americans is that in the last 20 years, the Americans have, through one way or another, got their noses into lots of conflicts. So they actually also have battle experience, which you mustn't write off. The Russians have battle experience, but the Chinese don't really. And I don't take the Chinese as seriously as I do the Russians. I actually think the Russians are, whatever the faults of the Russians are tougher and they're going to fight longer than the Chinese. And an interesting thing is the Russians and Chinese are supposed to be allies, and yet the Chinese, the entire year, the Chinese have not given Putin any weapons, and they've even said some negative things in public. So, and they're supposed to be allies. They were the two great communist powers. So, I think my view of China is very low.
Yeah.
If China tries to enter World War III in 2027, China's going to get clobbered.
Okay.
They're going to be hurt badly. You can say you heard it from me, and even if you don't believe it, but that's my view.
What about
and their, I can defend it.
What about their hypersonic missiles?
You know, I've heard about these hypersonic missiles, but I don't take any of these things seriously, because take, for example, a hypersonic missile. So you can fire a missile at great speed somewhere. The question is, what are you going to fire it at? And what is that thing that you're going to fire it at? Is it worth using it? Didn't Putin also come up with some hypersonic missile in the Ukraine war? I seem to recall some talk of a hypersonic missile from Putin, and that it even hit something. I recall something like that. Now, don't think the Americans don't have hypersonic stuff, eh? Just because the Americans aren't boasting about things doesn't mean they don't have them. And I looked at a lot of Chinese things. I think that a lot of Chinese things may look impressive, but there are many, many issues. How effective are they really? And what about countermeasures against them? Can they be shot down? Can you interfere with them in some way? You know, I've looked a lot at American aircraft things that the Americans have done over the years. Now, you may have noticed that in recent times there's been a lot of talk of UFOs.
Yes.
And there's been talk of UFOs being filmed by the U.S. Navy, etc. And I went and had a closer look at that. Those UFOs, all those UFO sightings occurred in military training areas off the coast of America. And they were filmed by military people.
Mm.
And those UFOs were traveling at something like 5,000 or 6,000 kilometers an hour. And they were making maneuvers that no other vehicle known to man can make.
Yes.
And people were starting again with all this nonsense of, oh, it's aliens, aliens, aliens. That stuff is not aliens. You are looking at probably drones, American drones, those are probably American drones that can fly themselves that are hypersonic. And you've got to ask yourself, what else are those drones doing that you don't know about? I did a bunch of videos in the past where I spoke about what they were doing at Area 51, Area 51 being a secret Air Force place in Nevada, in the 1960s. In the 1960s, Area 51 was producing the precursor to the SR-72 Blackbird, which went on to become the CIA spy plane. And the precursor to that was a secret aircraft called that had the code name of Oxcart. It was, I think the proper name for it was an A-10. Oxcart was a plane that could take off in America and fly to Russia within 2 to 3 hours and go anywhere over Russia. It could fly anywhere over Russia, and it could film and photograph any nuclear stuff that the Russians were doing. And they were doing it in the 1960s. And Oxcart was also responsible for 90% of UFO sightings. So it was a top secret plane. Nobody knew it existed. It was flying all over the show and going, and you couldn't shoot it down. The Blackbird was the next level up on Oxcart. You can't shoot it down. Missiles can't reach it. The fastest jet aircraft can't climb that high. They can't shoot at it. And it moves around and nobody can stop this thing. Americans have got seriously, seriously insanely advanced aerial capabilities, and they plow billions and billions of dollars into it. So those things that you think are UFOs are probably already existing spy planes that they're testing out, and you got to ask yourself, what else can those things do? So and another thing, for example, consider the first Gulf War. Consider when America went and attacked Saddam Hussein in the first Gulf War. People didn't even know that stealth jets existed, and stealth jets were flying over Baghdad dropping bombs. So let me tell you, the Americans, they've got insane technology. Don't knock them. The Americans can clobber the Chinese very easily.
Well, look, I've told this story before, but I think it's very relevant to tell it again. Back in the early 1980s, I saw a UFO outside my apartment in Escort in KwaZulu-Natal. And I don't know what it was, but I can tell you now that it was nothing that I knew that man could have made. This is early 1980s. This is 40 years ago. And what I saw was a cylindrical disc, which obviously did not have any problems with gravity. It was just floating slowly through the sky, and it just suddenly shot off. It was going way faster than 6,000 kilometers per hour from a standing start. It just went, phew, it was gone. This is 40 years ago. And you raised a very interesting point about the stealth fighters, because they first came out in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and we only heard about them in the late 1980s. So for 20 years, the Americans had these things, and they didn't tell anyone about them. So, yes, maybe they have got things that are anti-gravity, that are flying around, and you know, we just don't know about them.
Yeah, there is another plane that the Americans declassified that they'd kept as a secret, I think, for about 30 years. They only declassified it like about 15 years or so ago. It was a little drone. It was unmanned. It could fly at 3,000, I think it was 3,000, not sure if it's 3,000 kilometers an hour or 3,000 miles an hour, but it did at least 3,000 kilometers an hour. It flew over China in the 1960s, and it would take photographs and drop the photographs with a parachute. And they declassified that only about, like, say, 15 years ago. So that they were spying on China in the 60s with this top secret little thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, don't knock the West. The West has got insane technology. The West truly, and don't even underestimate the Europeans. Even small European countries, they've got some very advanced stuff, and you can see their stuff in this Ukraine war. Take for example Poland. Poland is not a country that you would say is a big military power, but Poland has produced a very interesting cheap heavy artillery weapon known as the Crab, and the Crab is proving to be a very good heavy artillery piece in the Ukraine war, and it's cheap.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Now, look, just talking about the Ukraine war, let's get back to Putin. Are there any things that Putin's army or his columns could have learned from the South African Defense Force battles of the 1980s?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I will tell you what there are a couple of things they could have learned, but the most important thing I saw was when I was watching right in the early part of the war, when Putin was sending in those huge armored columns to capture Kiev, and they were moving in this pincer, and they fought for weeks, and you saw these huge armored columns, and they were standing still on these roads, and they were blocked on these roads for ages as there was fighting going on. And the whole thing about the failure of the Russians to capture Kiev was now very interesting, and it was something that I'd been watching because I wanted to see house-to-house fighting, street battles, etc. And the Russians only got to the outskirts of Kiev, etc. But what was really astounding was when all those armored columns eventually kind of collapsed and retreated out of there. But the real big thing they could have learned from the SADF of the 1980s is that, have you looked at film footage of Russian armored vehicles, and you will see that the Russian armored vehicles are driving along tarred roads and driving along roads. But the South African Defense Force in the 1980s, possibly even as early as the 1970s, set the goal that their vehicles must be cross-country. They must not be stuck on roads.
Yeah.
And look at the Russians. They're huge, huge armored columns, and they're stuck on the roads. And you can see there are fields next to the roads. There are forests. And you're not even seeing these vehicles going there. They're just stuck there out in the open. And I did later read that the Ukrainians were, I'm not sure if you've lost, I may have lost the picture.
Yeah, you're back, but we've lost your picture. But yeah, just on that point while you're fixing that, Jan, what I noticed was that the Ukrainians, they took out the front two or three tanks in those huge convoys you're talking about, and that stopped the entire convoy in its tracks because they were all stuck behind that the one at the front. Are you there, Jan?
I'm actually struggling a bit with my camera. Just give me a second. I may have to put my camera back in.
Yeah, while you're doing that, I'll just give people a bit of background about those convoys. What actually happened was that, as Jan mentioned, Russia had these huge convoys which were going towards Kiev. And one of them apparently was about 50 kilometers long. Imagine how many vehicles were involved in that convoy. And just to stop them in their tracks, Ukraine took out the first few vehicles in that convoy. And of course, because they were taken out, they blocked the road. And the convoy was stopped in its tracks. And then they started taking out the vehicles that were stuck in that huge column. This is Ukraine. So it was a really stupid strategy that Russia used to just depend on the roads. And it was following those convoys being stuck that Russia then did this huge withdrawal from large parts of Ukraine. So, yeah, their strategy there was absolutely cactus. Jan, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I can hear you, but I can't get the camera back. We probably have to end the call and restart the call to get the camera back. I've tried everything I can do.
All right. Well, look, let me Skype you back. I'll call you straight back.
Okay. Let me just give me about 30 seconds to just get the camera tested.
Okay. All right, guys. Just while Jan is sorting out his camera, I'll just see what's happening in the side chat. Thank you all for joining us. And look, guys, it's getting close to Christmas, so just a very early, you know, have a great festive season. I hope the load shedding's not too bad over Christmas. And look, we'll be running up until the 20th of December. We'll be doing live streams until then. I'm going to take a couple of weeks break, and we do that because most of our guests are taking a break, and it's really hard to get people on live streams during that period, so it's better just to take a break at that time. I'm going to go and see if Jan is now fixed his camera. Let's just see what happens. Here we go. Okay, I think Jan is probably rebooting his computer. Okay, he says call now. Let's call now. Here we go. Hi, Jan.
Hi there, Scott.
You're back.
I did get the camera back. I did see the camera coming back. I think there may be something at your end because I could see myself.
Yeah.
In camera in the testing, and I have switched it on.
Hang on, there you go. Oh, no, it's a black screen. Oh, look, it doesn't matter. I'll just put up a map of Ukraine, just so we got something rather well. They can look at my ugly mug. How's that? Okay, let's continue. Okay, so we're talking about the South African Defence Force and how the vehicles were actually prepared or able to go across country, whereas the Russian vehicles weren't. And that was probably a huge issue when it came to the attempt to try and cut off Kiev, because all they had to do was take out a couple of vehicles. Now, just moving on with Ukraine, Jan, are there any weapons in the Ukraine war that were game changers? In other words, changed everything?
Yeah, this was also very interesting. The one thing that I'd expected, because I've been following drones for quite a few years, I'd expected drones to be important, and drones really came into their own in this war. People, both sides have been using drones in all sorts of ways, and it's been amazing. They've even used tiny drones, even small drones, just for spying and stuff, and all the things that they could do with drones. And the drones seem to be improving in leaps and bounds as both sides are using drones of all sorts of capacities. So the drones are very much something I expected. What I didn't expect was the power of normal artillery. I have known from my interest in military stuff that artillery is the queen of the battlefield. It's been like this for more than 200 years. Artillery is critically important. It was critically important from Napoleon right through World War I, World War II, right up to present times, even for the SADF. But I was very surprised when it turned out that artillery could be so decisive in this war. In fact, those armored columns that you were talking about, the artillery, when the Ukrainians had the Russians blocked like that in those long columns, the Ukrainians later said that they were using artillery to destroy tanks. And that was the first time ever that I've heard of using long-range artillery to destroy tanks. Because long-range artillery, where you fire into the sky and it's got to come down and hit a tank, it's a very, very, very difficult target. Yet that is exactly what the Ukrainians were doing, and that is exactly how the rest of the war has continued. And both sides are using artillery like crazy. And it's even normal troops are just getting killed with artillery. They're far away, you can't even see them, and the artillery shells are exploding there, and they've got to be very, very careful. They can't even walk around outside. The artillery of both sides are so good. But the real game changer that amazed me, just astounded me, was the HIMARS, the high-speed vehicles that are rocket launchers. There are a couple of them, but HIMARS is the best. Again, it's an American weapon, and it moves fast. It can do shoot and scoot, which means the way artillery works in this modern day and age, and the Russians already had this technology in the 70s, even here in Africa, is that if somebody fires some shells at you, using various military systems, you can actually figure out where the shell is coming from and how far it's come. So if somebody fires two or three shots at you, you can actually work out exactly where they are, even if they're like 20 kilometers away. And so the concept of shoot and scoot is that you go quickly to a place, you fire your stuff, and you get the hell out of there within like 15 minutes or so. Because if you stick around, the other side could be sending, could be firing right back at you, very close to you, very close. So HIMARS was amazing in its speed and its firepower. And it can fire missiles, it can fire rockets up to like, I think, almost 300 kilometers. So HIMARS was astounding. And the Ukrainians, we don't know exactly how many HIMARS they got. It could be as little as 16, but it might be more. You just don't know. But the Ukrainians were using these HIMARS, and what they did was they were targeting big Russian ammunition dumps. And they would blow these things up. And when they blow them up, these dumps would be burning and blowing up for hours and hours on end. And they caused so much damage. They blew up so many Russian artillery dumps that the Russian artillery began to have problems shooting because they're not getting enough ammunition. And the Ukrainians have been doing this for months now. And this is one of the key reasons why the Ukrainians were able to advance in the bits that they've managed to advance, because otherwise the Russians had enough firepower to pound the living hell out of them. But this HIMARS is probably the greatest weapon of all. And in that regard, we can even bring in what can you learn from the SADF. The SADF in the 1980s had the G5 and G6 artillery, the G5 being towed artillery, the G6 being self-propelled artillery. And at that time, the G6 had a range of about 50 kilometers, which at that time was probably about double the greatest distance of any other artillery in the world. The West, the Russians, the Americans, nobody had artillery that fired that far. Yet South Africa had it, And now we see that they're going even longer distances than South Africa had. So it's absolutely amazing the power of the artillery in this war.
Right. Okay, now I'm going to move on to another totally different part of the world now, because I think we've covered Ukraine quite extensively, and that is if we look at what's happening with China. Now, China is a real potential problem, and you mentioned earlier that they're no real threat to the United States of America, but if we look at what's going on with Taiwan, that's going to be a really, really dangerous situation, especially for countries like Australia. Here in Australia, if Australia, for example, gets involved on the side of Taiwan, if China invades Taiwan, what do you think is going to happen there? And do you think China will actually invade Taiwan?
You know, the Chinese Communist Party has said that invading Taiwan is their number one military goal. Because remember, Taiwan is actually the last portion of the Chinese Republicans, or whatever they were, the anti-communists. The anti-communists of China retreated to Taiwan at the end of the Chinese Civil War. So Taiwan is actually the last unfinished part of the Chinese Civil War, and the Communist Party wants to recapture that. Now, Taiwan is only about, I think it's roughly about 150 kilometers or so from the Chinese mainland. So you would think that with that plus about 20, I'm not sure their population, 20 or 23 million people, you would think that this mighty China can take Taiwan. But it's very interesting. I find it very interesting that the Chinese, despite making Taiwan their number one military target, they have never yet in all these decades actually been able to invade Taiwan. And there's lots and lots of stuff in the news. Earlier this year, a couple of months ago, there was a lot of stuff about China's about to invade Taiwan, China's about to invade Taiwan, but yet you don't see the Chinese actually making the move. Plus, the other side of the coin is, if the Chinese were going to invade Taiwan for real, then they would do it like the Russians did. They would, you wouldn't be reading about it in the news media for 3 or 4 weeks on end. It would just happen overnight. You just hear, oh, the Chinese are already attacking Taiwan. Nobody's going to talk about it up front. So many of these things where they say, oh, the Chinese are going to invade Taiwan, Chinese going to invade Taiwan, I regard it as a lot of propaganda, and I don't take it that seriously. Plus, the other thing is, what is China's actual capability? On paper, it looks pretty impressive. You know, the Chinese are 1 billion, and their army is about 2.8 million strong. And on paper, the Chinese Navy apparently has more vessels than the American Navy. But when you get closer and you start looking at the numbers more closely, then you will start seeing some funny things. You'll see, for example, the American Navy has got more than twice the tonnage of the Chinese Navy. So, yeah, the Chinese have got two aircraft carriers, but have you actually looked to see the comparison between an American aircraft carrier and a Chinese aircraft carrier? They are nowhere close in capabilities. The Americans have got 11 insanely enormous aircraft carriers. The Chinese have got two tiny ones. And the tonnage, the American vessels are bigger and heavier. On average, they're more than twice as heavy on average than the Chinese vessels. Plus, I'm going to bet you that in terms of actual electronics and stuff on board, electronics and other stuff that they've got, those Americans have got serious power. But let's focus on attacking Taiwan itself. The Chinese, what are the Chinese going to be able to attack Taiwan with? Well, they cannot send 2.8 million troops to Taiwan, because then they would not be able to defend themselves against India and their many other local enemies. So at the most, the Chinese can only send about 1.2 million troops. But they would have to take those troops, and those troops would have to get onto ships along the coastline of China. Those ships would have to sail quite a distance. We're looking at like 100 kilometers or more across the sea. They would have to face... The Taiwanese only have four submarines, but the Taiwanese have got an air force. The Taiwanese have got a navy. The Taiwanese have got radar. They would have to actually engage in all those preparations without others being aware. I can tell you, the Americans will know if they see troops loading up and in the harbors and things, you'd know. So the problem for the Chinese, firstly, is that unlike Putin, who just had to take his armored columns and go across the border, in the case of the Chinese, they have to load them up on ships, they have to bring the ships into harbor, they've got to then start sailing out. It's going to be a long, slow rigmarole, and there's a lot of logistics involved. So by the time they get to the coastline of the Taiwanese have got artillery and missiles and rockets and aircraft. The Taiwanese will already be engaging them out at sea, even before they get to the beaches, even before they get to the harbors. For the Chinese to actually properly be able to get their troops into Taiwan, they'll probably have to capture a port, because remember, the Allies in World War II, they had to bring artificial harbors to Normandy, and later they had to capture real ports so that they could bring normal ships in. So the Chinese have got a long problem, a big problem here. They're going to have to fight an army that is stocked up on weaponry, that is, whereas they've got to move all their stuff across the sea. Then they're going to have to fight house by house, street by street. And then it turns out that Taiwan is mountainous. It's got lots of forests. And do you know that the Taiwanese have planned to have a guerrilla army of 500,000 men who will fight an endless guerrilla war in the mountains and forests and towns of Taiwan? So by the time the Chinese get there, they're still going to face not just the conventional army, but a guerrilla army that's almost half the size of their army, and they're going to be facing a real long fight. I cannot see how the Chinese can win. I cannot see how the Chinese are going to have it easy. And I must tell you that I think that you would see many ships sunk at sea, destroyed at sea. They'd be destroyed by missiles, by submarines, by aircraft. You'd see a lot of dead Chinese. I reckon that whatever Putin has suffered in losses this year, it's nothing compared to what the Chinese would lose in just a week, in just 1 or 2 weeks of battle. Chinese will lose a lot of stuff. And then they still got to try and control 20 million people who've got an army of hundreds of thousands of guerrillas. And in mountains and forests and the heavy terrain there, I think the Chinese will suffer insane losses. I can't see that this is an easy thing for the Chinese. And if it had been easier, the Chinese would have done it already. I think the only hope for, to be honest with you, the only hope for the Chinese to invade Taiwan is to first go and nuke them. Go and drop a couple of nuclear bombs on them and then go and invade them. Otherwise, I think it's a total waste of time. I don't think it'll happen.
How about an EMP?
EMPs, that's an interesting one. If the EMPs are effective enough that they can knock out most of the electronics, that could help. But mostly military stuff, most military stuff can handle EMPs. It could help, yes, an EMP could be effective in knocking out all the civilian stuff. It would definitely bring the country to a halt. But I don't think it would stop the military stuff.
Right. Well, what is really interesting is the Taiwanese have stopped now providing China with the chips, because Taiwan is probably the world's largest producer of all these advanced chips that you find in mobile phones, you find in computers, the ones that like Intel use, which are basically the brains of your computer. And apparently in China now, they're really battling because Taiwan has said, we're not going to supply you with any of these chips anymore because you're threatening us. Now, this brings me to another point which is very, very relevant right now. And that is the fact that the Chinese people have had enough of Xi Jinping, and they're now starting to rise up in cities like Shanghai. Do you think that Xi Jinping could actually be turfed out by the people, by popular revolt?
This is very interesting. This, I think, is the greatest military threat to the Chinese, is internal unrest.
Yeah.
I was following it myself. Have you heard of the term? There's a Chinese term. It goes something along the lines of to lie down. Have you heard of that? It's a movement.
No.
Well, in China, there is a movement that's been spreading, especially among the youth, and it's a movement that millions of people have taken on, and it's a movement to sort of do the absolute minimum that they need to do in order to get by. And it's actually it's slowing down productivity across China, and it's such a threat that even the Chinese Communist Party has spoken out openly against this movement, that this thing needs to be controlled or stopped. And it seems to me that the Chinese have lost the will and the morale to carry on, and that they've been worked to death for the super rich for decades now, for the last 20 years, and it seems as if the Chinese people, the common Chinese person's getting sick of it. They're working like crazy, they're not getting much, and they're not able to actually get much better of a life, and they are actually starting to switch off. So bring this back to the whole Xi Jinping thing. Yes, there seems to be the beginnings of unrest inside China, and it's very fascinating that there are protests, that there's all kinds of resistance against the Communist Party. And that's another thing, that's another reason why, if the Chinese went and engaged in other military ventures, they could have serious need of military insight. As a general rule, in communist countries, this is right throughout the last 120 years, in communist countries, the military's main use is normally to kill the civilians, to kill and smash and crush the civilians. I'm sure you can remember Tiananmen Square.
Yep.
So you and I are old enough to remember Tiananmen Square. 1,000 people killed right in front of cameras, tanks rolled over them.
Yeah.
That's the Chinese Communist Party. I think the Chinese Communist Party will fight like crazy to retain control. As a general rule, and this also applies to South Africa, like the ANC, these people will fight to regain power even if they have to kill their own people. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Chinese murder people, kill people, and you will not hear about it. There's lots of stuff that China censors off the internet, and it's censored, and even Google and the others have to comply. So they will kill anyone they need to kill. I don't think that you'll see even the kind of openness that you saw among the Russians, where Russians were against Putin. I don't think you'll see that with the Chinese. I think the Chinese will go and they'll kill people, and people will disappear. And it's been very bizarre. Even this COVID lockdowns in China, the whole thing's so funny. I'm amazed at how many things are backfiring on stupid China. I regard them with contempt.
Now, just talking about that, the lockdowns, there's a lot of speculation that China is the test case for the New World Order. In other words, all these battles and wars they're talking about are just a distraction and just to create fear amongst the general population. But what's actually going on in China is what we can expect to see in the future if a one world government comes in. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, these crazy lunatics, super rich in the Western world, they have got all kinds of very demented ideas. And you're quite right that they want to control people. And they will, first of all, they'll stick their fingers into any pie. There's not a country they won't mess with. And they also are demented lunatics. They will do anything to the locals. So, yes, they would want to do things, especially in the Western world. And you can see all the weird, creepy COVID and other weirdo stuff that's going on in the Western world, LGBT, all kinds of weird stuff. Yeah. And notice it's anti-white and anti-male, anti-white male especially. And you'll hear all kinds of weird stuff like that. So yeah, there are some spillovers to China, but I don't think the New World Order actually fully controls China. And so I think the Chinese, the Communist Party in the end, I think the Communist Party will put up a fight. I can't say that I've seen or heard of anything that indicates that there's some kind of opposition that could take on the Chinese Communist Party. But maybe we are seeing the beginnings of big unrest in China. Maybe the long term is a civil war in China at some point, and that we are seeing the beginnings of something like that.
Right. Okay, now, how has the Chinese army performed in other wars in recent decades?
Well, that's a very interesting topic, and I did some digging into that. The Chinese actually, the last time that the Chinese fought a proper war was in Vietnam, neighboring Vietnam. And Vietnam is actually a communist state, but it's communist linked to the Russians. In the time of the Vietnam War, when the Americans were fighting there, the Russians were the main ones supplying the weaponry to the Vietnamese. So the Vietnamese are actually closely aligned with the Russians, I think, to this day. Anyway, in 1979, the Chinese decided to invade Vietnam, and they went in with somewhere between 300,000 troops, maybe as many as 600,000, but at least 300,000. So it's like about double the amount of troops that Putin used this year. And they went in with anything from 400 to 500 tanks. They crossed the border and they hit three different regions. And Vietnam is quite small. And they fought against mostly against a Vietnamese infantry army, half of which was militia, and the other half was proper troops. But they weren't fighting high-tech weaponry. The Vietnamese didn't have tanks. The Vietnamese didn't have missiles. But the two sides fought each other for a month. The Russians killed about 1,000 the Chinese killed about 1,000 Vietnamese a day, and the Vietnamese killed about 1,000 Chinese a day. They fought for a month. The Chinese advanced, I think, a total of about 20 kilometers, only 20 kilometers into Vietnam, and after about a month, the Chinese army withdrew in its entirety. So they both lost about 30,000 dead for a month of fighting, and just normal infantry along with some militia, which aren't high-quality infantry, had managed to take on the whole Chinese army plus armor. And they gave them a very hard time. It was not a good outcome for the Chinese. And that was the last time the Chinese fought a war against anyone. And the Chinese, I might add, have had some border incidents with the Indians in recent times. And these border incidents, the Chinese came off second best against the Indians every time. It was small-scale fights where a couple of guys get killed here and a couple of guys get killed there. But the Indians actually clobbered the Chinese on both occasions. And I don't know if you've seen this, but there was a video. You can find it on YouTube. You can just Google crying Chinese soldiers. There was a video that the Indians were spreading around on their social media of these Chinese soldiers in buses heading for the Indian border, and these Chinese soldiers are singing, but if you look closely at them, they're crying. and the Indians were laughing at it. They were mocking them. And I must tell you that between China and India, I actually rate India a much more... I think the Indians can hurt the Chinese badly. And with regard to the whole Taiwanese thing, the Americans are trying to create some kind of alliance between India, Japan, Australia, America, and Taiwan, so that Taiwan has got support in the event of an invasion. Kind of a strange thing, but I don't think the Chinese are going to be able to go far myself.
Right. Okay, I'm just actually playing that video of the Chinese soldiers crying.
Reportedly, these are new recruits that they are saying are being transported to the LAC. In one of the clips that you can see on your screens, some of these...
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, they're crying, yeah. Oh my gosh, it's like the Russian troops in Ukraine. They just kind of give up, don't they? I've seen tanks just handing themselves over to the Ukrainians.
Yes, there's a morale issue. The Russians are struggling. The Russians, if you look at the Russians over the last 200 years or so, you'll see that the Russians never do well in the beginning of a war. And the way the Russians manage to survive is because Russia is so big and there are so many, they manage to learn over a period of time. Whether they were fighting Napoleon or the Wehrmacht or whoever, they do very badly in the beginning. And it takes them quite a while to sort of get their act together. Since you are interested in that, I'll tell you something I've heard. I've heard it recently. And you're welcome to check it up to see if it's true.
Right.
I know for a fact, in World War II, the Russians had units. There was a special type of unit that when the Russians went into action against the Germans, that behind the Russians were other Russian units with machine guns, and if the Russians retreated, they were mowed down by their own side. I heard it the other day from a military guy. I've not checked it up, but I've heard that in Ukraine there is something similar. There is some kind of unit behind the Russian units that if Russians retreat, they get shot. So that may be something to investigate to see if that is true. But there is a morale problem. I will agree with you, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, now, are there any other wars that you think can happen in the next few years?
The thing that I think is the most likely, of all the things I've looked at, the thing that I think might be something that could turn into something is Turkey. The leader of Turkey is a guy called Erdogan. And Erdogan is very much, he's almost like a Turkish Putin. But he's a Putin who actually really fights. And he's quite aggressive, and he says pretty nasty things, and he plays quite a big role. He's even involved in NATO, and he seems to be a very confident guy. Now, Erdogan has been making threats against Greece, but the interesting thing about the Turks is that the Turks have been involved in fighting, especially in Syria, against the Kurds. And they've been fighting against the Kurds. And in Turkey, they've also gone, and there are people in Turkey who actually invented their own drones. They built their own drone technology in Turkey. And those drones are quite cheap, and they're pretty good. The Ukrainians, I know, bought some of them. They were used to great effect in a conflict called, I think it's Nagorno-Karabakh, a year or two ago, where these Turkish drones were blowing up tanks in Armenia, I think it was. It was a war there, yeah. There close to Turkey. Anyway, those drones are pretty damn effective, and the Turks have got quite good military power. They've got quite a lot of experience in combat. They've fought in Syria. They've got these drones, and they outnumber the Greeks like about almost 2-1. So there seems to be gas and oil that's been found somewhere near the Greek islands, and the Turks have been making lots and lots of noise and threats about the fact that those islands belong to Turkey now.
Isn't that the Armenian territory that they're now trying to take away from what's left of Armenia, the Turks?
No.
That's to the east.
Armenia is landlocked. It's inside Asia.
It's stuck between Turkey and, I think, Kazakhstan. It's sort of like this little strip. But apparently, to get the oil from one side through to Turkey, they have to go through Armenia, and that's where the problem is, because they don't want that Armenian territory being part of their pipeline, so that's why they're trying to take over Armenia. That's what I've heard.
That could very well be. I don't have knowledge about that, but that could very well be. I think it's Kazakhstan or something.
I'll pull it up on the map here so we can have a look. Just get it geographically so we can understand where it is. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So you think that Turkey could be another war situation?
Yes, I think it could be a small war. I think the Turks might make a move at some point. I think I would rate that a Turkey-Greece conflict is is more likely than a China-Taiwan thing.
Right.
So, of course, the thing is, what scale would it be? It wouldn't be very big, but it does seem like it is an ongoing issue here. Though I think that the Greeks would give them a good kick in the teeth.
But
it does look like they could stir there.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's for sure, but that looks like that's a sore point, that place.
Yeah, just so people watching know what we're looking at, that's Armenia, that map there. And Azerbaijan is where the oil and the gas is that Jan's talking about. And Turkey is over here. So you can see that they're actually separated by this thin piece of land owned by the Armenians. And what's happening is Turkey is now invading this area here because they want to get pipelines through and own the land where they have pipelines coming through from Azerbaijan to Turkey. So this is actually happening right now. The world's just not talking about it. And just for location, you can see Georgia up here, just to the north. Georgia is bordering Russia, and of course Ukraine is further up above here. But that's where Armenia is. It's what's left of what used to be a huge population who were victims of a genocide back in the early 1900s, and that was just quite shocking. Sorry, back to you, Aya.
No problem.
Yeah, I just wanted to give context to talking about Armenia and Turkey. All right. Now, what do you think of the Muslim terrorist war that's taking place in Mozambique at the moment?
That has been interesting me for the last 2 years or so. I found that very, very fascinating. And this whole Muslim thing in Africa where Muslims are fighting blacks, I find it, first of all, I find it very funny. I enjoy it. I think it's humorous. I enjoy it because these blacks who took over Africa thought that, when they get rid of colonialism, that life is going to be living happily ever after when the white man is gone. And I find it quite hilarious that these Middle Easterners looked on these blacks and said, you know, but we can maybe go and chew a bit off of their cake. And you'll find that there are quite a few Muslim-type conflicts in Africa, even in the Congo. But the one in Mozambique blew my mind, and I followed that from the beginning. And it was very interesting that they had less than 1,000 troops. But most of these Muslims are actually blacks. Blacks
yes.
who convert to Islam.
And they came down through Tanganyika from the north.
Yes, could be. And they convert to Islam, and now they're part of the Islamic setup. And they somehow managed to get some weapons. And do you know that there are also hints that Muslims in South Africa might be helping and assisting,
yes,
maybe with money?
Yeah.
So maybe some Indians in South Africa are helping to fund that war.
Well,
but anyway, I found it very hilarious that Frelimo, who used to be our enemy, that Frelimo are finding that they got this stupid war up there in the north of Mozambique. And then of course there was that small mercenary group called Van Dyke, which is a white guy from Zimbabwe with some South Africans working for him. And they then went and got like a sort of a military contract. They actually do anti-poaching stuff, but they then got involved in the fighting, and they did that for a year or two, and they were busy shooting up those Muslims, and they were actually doing it from civilian helicopters, just with AK-47s, and I think later maybe even a machine gun, and they were actually proving to be the most effective killers of these so-called Muslims. And the Muslims at that point numbered a bit less than 1,000, but that was at the time that they went and captured that town. And
Palmer.
These Van Dyke mercenaries came, and they were shooting them up and chasing them back, etc. And the Mozambican army was supposed to be helping, but the Mozambican army would run away. And you know, those mercenaries weren't many. They were something like 30 guys, probably 20 of them white and a couple black.
Yeah.
And so it's like a little group of like 30 guys with like two helicopters or three helicopters or something. And they were actually the most effective combat force when the Frelimo army was actually running away. Anyway, they ended up shooting some civilians, or so it was said. And eventually they and the government decided to part company. And so that was when they then, the whole thing is, I find the whole thing very funny. I think the whole thing is absolutely hilarious, is that then they decided to bring in the Southern SADC or whatever it is, the Southern African grouping, and then everybody got involved, including the ANC and what have you. The Rwandans came down from there. The Rwandans came and fought those terrorists, and I'm under the impression that it might be the French. The French might have asked the Rwandans or paid the Rwandans to go and fight there, because you know that oil and gas stuff there belongs to Total Oil, which is French.
Right.
And so I think the Rwandans came at the behest of the French. The Rwandans came and clobbered the mercenaries quite a bit, because the Rwandans have got a lot of battle experience. But then South Africa and Botswana and all these others got involved. And the last I heard was that in total there is something like 3,000 troops there, half of them being South African. And I know a couple of people. There were a couple of soldiers killed. I think one so-called Raki, but we cannot compare the modern Rakis with the Rakis of the SADF. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, I believe last year December one of the Rakis, quotes Rakis in inverted commas, got shot. But anyhow. From what I've been able to pick up is that it almost seems as if they're trying to starve them out, that they're actually not really fighting much, and they're trying to starve them out and sort of chase them away, and And I haven't actually seen anything in quite a few months. I need to maybe go and update a bit again.
My understanding is that these ISIS guys in northern Mozambique are actually recruiting, they're forcing children to become child soldiers. And that's where they now got their numbers. That's what I heard.
Well, that could well be, but that would not be would be nothing new for Africa. Both MPLA in Angola as well as ANC have made good use of children. That would be par for the course for Africa.
Talking about South Africa, what are your thoughts of the massive July unrest that happened last year in KZN?
Scott, I would say that that to me is the greatest kind of trial run for racial conflict that we've yet seen. And I found that very fascinating, extremely fascinating. The strange stuff that they did. They didn't target whites openly because they were going after Ramaphosa's allies and Ramaphosa's link to the rich. But they seemed to target, let's call it the rich globalist whites of South Africa, as well as Ramaphosa's buddies, as well as the Indians, because the Indians are known for their wealth.
Yeah.
So the whites actually, well, first of all, it was very fascinating for me just to see the blacks actually attempting some kind of mass attack type of thing. Your sort of Sinner van Rensburg type of theoretical thing. And it was very fascinating to watch it and to monitor it. I actually still want to do a video about it because there's a bunch of film footage that I've got that I wanted to compile into a proper video about it.
Right.
Because there's some very interesting stuff, especially the shooting part. The shooting part was so fascinating. And I found the whole thing very, very fascinating to see how... Look at how the police, for example, the police went and hid away hid away for days.
Yeah, they were useless, absolutely useless.
They were the SAP was totally useless. They went and hid away
You know what struck me, Jan, was that after the chaos, the mainstream media were then suggesting that the Indians, I think it was in Chatswood, who had taken out a number of rioters, were racist. That was the big story. The racist Indians. Not the chaos that people are watching right now, because I've actually got a video of what happened back in July last year. But that was the fake mainstream media spin, is racism.
Well, that may relate to the so-called Phoenix Massacre.
Yeah.
Where the blacks came,
and they came very short.
They came to kill the Indians, and they ended up getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I found it hilarious. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. Here are these blacks coming to specifically murder the Indians, and the Indians end up killing like 38 of them. And I've even got a bit of film footage where the Indians went and burnt down a shanty town.
Yeah.
And the Indians hit back, and the Indians fought back. And so suddenly when the blacks who started all the trouble, suddenly all of a sudden the blacks are the victims. Oh, they're the victims, yeah. They're the victims, blah, 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 blah. I thought it was hilarious, and you know what? There's a historic thing in this, and that is the following: that the Indians in, let's say, in the time of black freedom, let's call it black freedom, since colonialism, you know, the blacks murdered something like 10,000 or more Indians in Zanzibar, and and the blacks have slaughtered Indians. So blacks, plus in 1949 in Durban, the blacks, the Zulus, set out to exterminate the Indians as well. And then the South African police, the whites, came and shot a whole bunch of, spent the night shooting blacks and saving the Indians. Anyway, the bottom line is that this is historic in that it is the first time that Indians have stood their ground and shot and killed blacks.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a very important event that the Indians could shoot back. I was amazed by it. There were even some Indians with AK-47s that I saw. I was absolutely astounded by it. And I think it bodes well.
I just want to interrupt for a second, Jan. I'm showing some video footage of the massacre in Zanzibar that took place a few years ago now. Yeah, back to you.
Yeah. No problem.
So
the fact that the Indians fought back, that to me was like the cherry on the top, the icing on the cake, something I'd never expected to see. And it certainly, and also that the blacks were targeting the Indians as a specific racial target. I think that that is one of the dumbest things the blacks have ever done. And I think it's fantastic. I think it was a wonderfully stupid thing that they did, and it will bode well for the future. And I looked at the way whites did things. From what I officially, 354 people were killed, but it mean to me it's like 90% of the people who were killed last year were blacks. They were the blacks who were shot.
Yeah.
And I also was speaking to someone who was involved in it in Durban, and they were saying that those numbers that we see of 354 dead, those numbers were not the real numbers. The real numbers are much, much higher. And so the other thing is that to this day, I've not come across anyone who can point to a white person who was killed in that event. I don't know if you know of it, but I certainly have never come across any reference to a white person who was killed. But I do know that whites defended their suburbs, kept the blacks out. And when I look at the whole thing of what happened in that July, I must tell you, there are so many useful lessons that can be learned from it. And also the way the whites behaved, whites were behaving very well. And I know that whites were even loading up. There were some whites who paid for a light aircraft to be filled with ammunition, and the ammunition was flown from Johannesburg down to Durban, and they quickly stocked up and handed out ammunition to people. So all in all, when I look at what actually happened then, I think it went very well for, let's call it, the whites and the Indians. And I think that anybody who fears the future should study that more closely, because there are lots of lessons. And the way that the whites went and protected their suburbs and blocked roads and the whole thing of how people defended themselves, it came out very well.
Yeah.
I thought it was awesome. I thought that the whole thing, it was thought through by communists linked to Zuma. And I must tell you that on the whole, I think that this bodes very well for the future. That and now also whites can see that, yes, you know, blacks can try wild, crazy, lunatic stuff, but you can actually see lessons from people who were involved in it. And I reckon this bodes well. There is just one negative about this, and it is this: I have been hearing that Zulus are becoming very racist, and that there's a lot of racial stuff going on in Natal. And I think that it may be that these silly Zulus are now with their Zuma and their communist buddies. Remember, a long time ago, we thought the Zulus might be allies, that they'd be like with Buthelezi and they'd be allies. But now it seems they are firmly on the Zuma camp. And I actually think that Natal is a dangerous place for whites, and whites should actually be very careful. I was looking at the low number of whites that are there. Whites in Natal should be especially careful.
Okay, I just want to paint a hypothetical situation for you. Let's say with KZN, let's say that the shops don't have any food. The Zulu population are going very hungry, and you've got these white affluent suburbs. Aren't they just going to be such a target for gangs, and you know, isn't this the impending danger as we move into 2023?
Okay, well, if the blacks are looking for food and stuff, their first and best places to go to would be to attack shopping malls and shopping centers and shops.
But if there's no food, yes, if they're empty?
Well, it can eventually come to the suburbs. And yes, I will agree with you that what we are facing in the long run, I definitely agree with you that in the long term, we are going to see, I think, regardless of how things go in South Africa, I think that for the decades that lie ahead, the real battle is going to be the battle of the white suburbs, definitely. That is definitely coming. Right. That whites are going to find that the battle of the suburbs is coming.
So prepping and being armed, obviously, and having support groups like Neighborhood Watch or, you know, some armed little commando that can actually fight back is what you're saying.
Yes, and also people should start looking at proper defensive tactics that work in warfare.
Yeah.
First and foremost, blocking of roads. Block roads. Defend critical road junctions. You know, you can stop lots of people from getting into your suburbs by finding key places to block and that kind of thing. On the other hand, things that work will help us is, thanks to crime, everybody's got some kind of fencing. Some people even have, I mean, if you look at some people's houses, there are even people with houses with big strong walls and things. There's a lot of stuff that can be done if people start thinking in a sort of a military mindset. But yes, I think the battle of the suburbs, protecting the suburbs, early warnings for suburbs, and yes, like a commando for the suburbs, definitely, and like quick reaction forces that can come in and help you. These, I think that this is the long-term future of South Africa, definitely. Yeah.
Now, just talking about that, and I just need to explain to people who just joined the live stream that the reason we're showing footage of a Chinese parade is because Jan's camera's not working, and this is far more interesting than looking at me. So that's, we were talking about China a short while ago. So let's get back to South Africa. We've talked about, in fact, we're going to be talking about secession in a few days' time with Dr. Peter Hammond and a couple of the people who are involved in these secession movements. Do you think that is probably the only safe way for the white population to go, is to have this little territory that they defend and actually make independent from the rest of South Africa?
I'm a huge fan of secession, but there are many aspects to this thing. There are many, many aspects to this. You see, one of the things that whites are struggling with and are going to struggle with, before I answer that question, is that whites need some kind of political platform. And the problem with whites and a political platform is that what does it help to have a white political platform in the new South Africa, okay, in the new and much retarded South Africa? What if, even if all the whites vote for whites, it's not going to help us anyway. We're just going to get like a handful, maybe at best, if all the whites vote for a whites-only political party, if such a party would even be allowed to exist, we would at most maybe get like, what, five members of parliament or something. So we are stuck with the fact that we don't have some kind of political thing that we can do. And this is one of the reasons why I'm a huge fan of secession. In fact, I'm a fan of secession, and I don't even care who secedes or how they secede or which piece of territory they want to secede with, because secession opens up nightmares that the ANC does not want, and the ANC will try the ANC will try to crush any secession movement of any kind in the most ruthless manner.
But with so, what? With what? You haven't got an army. You haven't got a police service. South Africa is basically in a state of anarchy already. I was speaking to Patricia just a couple of nights ago. She's a whistleblower who's now been targeted by the police. They're trying to take her out because she's telling people what's going on. And she made the point that the people running the South African Police Service are all ANC cadres. They haven't got a clue what they should be doing. That they might have a position as a brigadier and looking after the weapons or whatever. And this guy has come from the bush and he has no idea. So if you look at that, and the same applies with the army, which is why it's such a disgrace with what happened last year in July, it would be so easy to rise up and just say, okay, get out of here, this is now our territory, and they would have no answer. The only thing they could do is bring in something like the United Nations.
Well, Scott, I think I can now leave the show because you've stolen all my thunder and you are way ahead on this game. Because you are seeing exactly what I'm seeing. So I'm just not saying it in as many words, because I'm looking at it and I'm laughing at it and I'm saying to myself, we can just as well take our own territory, Scott. We could just as well secede a whole bunch of territories in South Africa. There's plenty we could try to seize if we had the initiative. And you are quite right. I'm 100% on your side, because this is why I'm so in favor of secession. There is nothing stopping us from from taking, let's say a couple of suburbs in one of the major cities, or even one of the cities. And we take a chunk of one of the cities and we give it a freaking name and we say, well,
as long as you don't call it, as long as you don't call it the Vatican, I don't mind. Okay, back
and,
to you.
And you go and you give it some freaking name and you say, well, you know what? The population of this area, this particular area, 70% of the population of this area is white Afrikaner, yeah, or Boer Afrikaner, and you know what? It might measure 5 kilometers by 5 kilometers, but we declare it our own state and it's ours, and we will not allow the SAPS in here. We are looking after our own stuff, etc.
Yeah.
We are, let's say, 50,000 strong or whatever. I must tell you, Scott, this is now you are thinking along the lines that I've been sitting and pondering myself. And if whites would just start thinking more like this, Scott, I'm telling you, we can seize. And you know what? You mustn't think in terms of one particular contiguous piece of territory. Think of a bunch of territories that we could turn into our own states. But here's the proviso. Here's the key element. Number one, it must be territory that we live in. It must be stuff we live in. It's where our homes are. That's the number one thing. Number two, we must be willing to defend it ourselves. If we are willing to do those two things, we could create a territory or a set of territories, mark them out on a map, and say, this is a Afrikaner, Boer Afrikaner, Volkstaat. And here is its boundaries. Its boundary is in this city, boundaries in that city. They're not quite joined, but it doesn't matter. Here is where our people live. This is where we are, and we will defend each other. And of course, if you start thinking in those terms, all you have to do is go one step further. You've got the politics sorted out. You've got the military and the defense sorted out. All you need to do is do one more step, Scott, and that is you have to ask yourself, what is going to be our economy? What is going to be the economy that we can function with that can work? Because if you look around, you'll see the super rich are stealing everything that they can. The ANC is stealing everything they can. the only people who are not stealing are the whites. And I think it's I think that once we have our territory, we need to say, okay, we got to steal something from somebody. We got to steal something that's going to bring us an income. What is it that's important enough that we can steal? And maybe we can target some of those mines or something else. And once we start looking at economic things and we say, you know what? Hey, you see that power station over there? That power station could belong to us, and we could sell the power from that power station, and we can make it run. Once you start thinking in that sort of way, Scott, then it's the game is on. Then the game is on, and because I look at this country and I look at what's going on, and I say everybody is stealing except us. Everybody is stealing, everybody is murdering, and so forth except us. So we might as well start defending ourselves. We don't need the SAPS. The SAPS has done nothing for us for the last 26 or 28 years.
Can I just say, Young, that when I look at Bekele, I see, and I'm not being racist, but I see a chimpanzee wearing a hat. That's what I see. I mean, seriously. It's a complete joke that he should be the Minister of Police. Seriously.
Well, Scott, all I'm going to say to you, my friend, is that when I look at the kinds of people who rule us, I say to myself that never in the history of European people have we sunk so low as to be ruled by such arrant garbage. Mm. And by the way, I've heard people make jokes about Becky Sele that he may be the Minister of Police, but he dresses like yes. But I mean, these people, and you know, I've even spoken to people. Scott, I once worked with a Afrikaans girl who she was very creative. Scott, she at a point she had two contracts in two different companies at the same time. So she was working for two places at the same time, and she was coming up with bullshit stories, and she had people covering for her in the one while she dashes off to the other one. And she reported to some high-ranking ANC guy in one of the companies, and she came and she said to me, Jan, I can't remember her insult, but it was very similar to the insult that you gave Becky Sele. She said to me, he's got so much power, and he's as dumb as a rock. You know, he's dumber than a plank.
My pot plant in my kitchen has got a higher IQ than Becky Sele. Seriously. Now look, I'm gonna wrap up this live stream, but just in closing. What do you think the future will be for Western civilization? So if we look beyond 2022.
Scott, I think that the path forward is that the globalists have tried their best, the communists have tried their best, and even the globalist communist buddy system is not working anymore. And I see lots of instability in the world. And I don't see any indication, I see no reason at all to believe that the instability is going to come right and that we're going to go back to what we were at. I don't see that for South Africa. I don't see it for America. I don't see it. And even Europe is starting to become unstable. And you know, they're going to flood 60 million blacks or so into Europe in the next 10 years. Scott, I think that we are on our way towards serious unrest, and I think we're almost entering an age of civil wars, which will become racial wars, and that is where we're going. But the beauty is that it's not just going to be white South Africans on their own. You're going to find all this crazy stuff happening all over. But we in South Africa are at the front. And I must tell you, Scott, the fact that you are seeing the things you are seeing, and you are perceiving that and passing that on to people, let me tell you, the path forward is the path to freedom. Let this disgusting, anti-white, white-hating system collapse, And, you know, imagine if whites weren't paying tax to SARS, where would SARS be? Where would this whole system be? And, you know, I think that the path to freedom is closer than you think. If only whites can learn to stick together, and there are certain allies that we can have, like maybe the Indians and the Muslims will be excellent allies. And, you know, and who knows what the coloreds might be like, you know, but we must stick together for ourselves. The Boere and I want to tell you, nothing's going to happen in South Africa if the Boere Afrikaners don't stick together. The Boere must stand firm, and we must dig our heels in and get ready, because I tell you that our chance for freedom is closer than you think. And leave these people to continue with their chaos. They are the ones that are constant failures. Let them carry on failing. Let this thing collapse. But what we need to do is we need to think very carefully, and we need to think very strategically, and we need to be ruthless. I must tell you, look around you, and you're going to see everybody in the world is stealing. And if we don't steal for our group, then we're not going to go anywhere. And nobody's going to give us anything. They're going to keep stealing from us. Malema's going to keep wanting the land from us and all these others. So at a point, we're going to have to grab some land of our own, steal what we need to steal for our own state, and then dig our heels in.
Yeah.
Look, I reckon we can fight them to a standstill.
Yeah. Look, I totally get what you're saying, because there are two sets of rules in play here. You've got the white minority group and the Indian minority group, and a large percentage of the colored minority group, who are basically playing by the rules. And then, unfortunately, the ANC cadres are playing a completely different game, where they're stealing everything. And I'm not in South Africa, but if I was in South Africa, I tell you what, I would be so involved in breaking a large chunk of the western part of South Africa, which is largely Afrikaans speaking, away from the rest of South Africa, because the options are so obvious. I mean, what's going to happen is that the ANC, because they're just a bunch of mafia, are going to destroy what's left of South Africa. And the beauty about the western part of South Africa right now breaking away from the rest of South Africa is that it's not infiltrated or completely degraded by the World Economic Forum. So you could have this little island in the world which has not been infiltrated by the New World Order, namely the Western Cape or that part of the South Africa, new country, totally outside the globalist desires of these elite or parasites, I call them. So the timing would be perfect for that part of South Africa to break off, set up its own territory, and say middle finger to the rest of the world. Because I tell you what, there'd be a huge influx of people back into South Africa, and I'm talking about people with brains. You know, they would be pouring into the country, and it could be a little heaven on earth when the rest of the world just becomes a complete mess under the World Economic Forum. So that's my thoughts, and the two options are so obvious to me. What are your thoughts?
Scott, I'm going to say to you two things. It doesn't matter who wants to break away. Any breakaway is good. So the big thing, there are a couple of things that need to be done. When the breakaway occurs, you see, the thing that you need is you need a political platform. And so the breakaway is the excuse. The breakaway gives you the excuse that you need to engage in your political platform. And that is the most important thing. And it doesn't matter really where it is. All whites should support it, because once that thing gets going, then the ANC is going to try to break this with all their might. Let me tell you, they will use every dirty trick that they can.
Yeah.
And don't worry about the the police and the army. They'll arm up militias and they'll come at you.
Yeah, but look, the ANC couldn't organise a barbecue in a park, so I'm not too worried about that.
Scott, I'm telling you, there's nothing I can teach you anymore. I am not going to be able to come on your show. because you're seeing it so clearly. And Scott, you got to understand, before you shoot people, you've got to... You see, if you just go and kill people, then that's terrorism. But if you have a political platform and you say, listen... This is what I want to do, and here it is, and here are the legal documents, and we went to the court, and blah blah blah. You need all that stuff up front, because we know that the ANC is going to dispute it, is going to fight it, and they are actually going to break their own constitution and their own laws. That is actually one of the funniest things of all that's happening. Is the ANC breaks the law of the very constitutions and things that they're supposed to defend.
Yeah.
So you know. And we need whites to move forward, put something in front of them, shove it in their face, say, listen, this is it, and here is our piece of paper, and we can show it to the United Nations, and we can show it to the Americans, everybody. Because the piece of paper is very important, because later when people start shooting each other, they need to understand, oh yes, there is this piece of paper, okay?
Yeah.
But once you start the ball rolling, Scott, once that ball gets rolling and the ANC starts hitting you, let me tell you, Scott, their opportunities are beyond imagination.
Absolutely.
Forget about it. Forget about it just being a little chunk of territory in the Western Cape.
Yeah.
Scott, there's plenty of South Africa that can be recovered. Plenty.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna tell you a little secret. I'm busy with something. I'm busy with something very technical that I'm working on.
Careful what you say, because you're in South Africa. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, I'm busy with a little bit of something. It's going to turn into a video, but when I've finished it, I will be coming to you, and I will present it to you, and it will be a very interesting discussion, and it will be a discussion that adds value to the discussion that we've just had. So I think that discussion will be of tremendous interest to you, and we will probably be doing it early in next year. So
fantastic.
You stick around. We're going to have some serious discussions, because I must tell you, if whites don't take some kind of group action as a group, and you know what? Forget about the notion. Forget about liberals winning in 2024. They'll cheat at the elections. The DA will never rule the country. The DA can't even control some of the stuff. But let them try. But the way I see it, between the ANC, Malema, Zuma, the Communist Party, they're all much of a muchness, and they help each other, and. They will never allow anything for whites. There's so many rules against whites. And what we need to do is stand together. You know, if we stand together and we say, hey, all we want is this little piece of land, and, you know, we are a majority here. And you know, Scott, I'd even add this, is that, you know, people are talking about human rights. And listen to this, Scott. If it was morally wrong for white people to colonize Africa and to rule black people, if it was morally wrong for white South Africans to rule black South Africans, then why is it morally right for blacks to rule whites? Why can't white people rule white people? Why can't Indian people rule Indian people? Why can't colored people rule colored people? And if we say, look, we just want a little place to live, and we want to rule ourselves, and we have our own culture. We have our culture. So, and do you know that the Boere, that the Boere, the Boer republics, the original Boer republics, Transvaal, the Free State. Do you know that some years ago, when I had a mentor, Dr. Chris Jordan told me that, and he was involved in military intelligence stuff. Chris Jordan said to me that they had done some investigations, and that the Boere can qualify for an EU state, because an EU state has got a couple of rules. You must be able to prove historically that you did have a piece of territory that you did rule that was internationally recognized, and the Transvaal and the Free State were such Absolutely. Territories. You also need to prove that you are a nation. To prove that you are a nation, you must prove that you've got a language of your own, which the Boere do have.
Yeah.
And you can even prove that you've got your own culture, their religion and stuff. The Boere have got every valid proof to prove that they were a nation and that they want to be a nation again. I'm gonna tell you a little joke. I'm gonna make a little joke quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've often thought to myself, imagine the Boere send out a notice to the ANC in Pretoria and Bloemfontein and wherever, and they say, listen, by order of the Boere Republic, we're giving you 48 hours to get out of here because we're reclaiming our territory. Yeah, 48 hours to
effect yourself. That would go down like a ton of bricks.
But anyway, to be honest with you, Scott, I want to tell you that once you get past all the let's call it all the verbal bullshit, all the political bullshit, and the ANC tries to start smashing people, then the game is on. If they use violence, we can use violence. And Scott, I want to tell you, you forget about whites just owning just a little piece of desert. You're going to be shocked by the things that are possible.
Well, look, we're going to return to that. I just want to interrupt you on that point, because I know a couple of people in South Africa, and obviously I'm not going to say who they are or where they are, but they reckon there are huge caches of arms, and when the white population have had enough, if I put it that way, you know, the SANDF won't stand a chance. It'll be all over Red Rover in 5 minutes flat.
Scott, I will have this. You and I will have a very similar discussion. We will have a very interesting discussion on exactly this kind of topic. We're gonna talk about some of the stuff, because I must tell you, Scott, that if the whites could just have confidence in themselves as a group, you'll see that we'll be okay. We're going to be okay. But we've got to get away. We've got to get away from this notion that we need security guards, we need others. We're going to have to start taking responsibility for ourselves. We're going to have to physically man up, and each one of us is going to have to get some kind of personal weapon and be willing to stand our ground. And I will tell you, for example, because you probably want to close, but I do want to tell you that in Kulini in 2017, when Malema's people were making huge trouble in Kulini and they were trying to even burn down people's houses, I went there afterwards, I took photographs, and I spoke to people who were very closely involved, and I heard very interesting stuff that has never been published. And I want to tell you something, that one thing that I heard was, most Kulini is a tiny little town, but most of the whites live in one sort of suburb. At a point when all these blacks were there toying and making lots of violence, and they'd also rush down the streets and they'd break things, the white men of Kulini got together and they all went and got their weapons, and they stood on the street corners around their suburb, guarding their suburb. And when the blacks saw the white men standing there with their weapons, the blacks toyed all they wanted, and they went and bashed other things and broke other people's shops. Yeah. The blacks stayed away from the white men with their guns, even though they were just armed with normal, like, you know, a couple of normal, simple weapons that you have. Yeah. When the blacks saw that the whites had their guns out, the blacks knew, keep your freaking distance. And this is the kind of thing that that we need to prepare for. And I want to tell you, Scott, that if even small groups of whites worked in teams, you would be amazed what we could do.
I just want to clarify my thoughts on this, and that is that I think that the overwhelming majority of the black population are good people. They're hardworking. They're trying to bring up children. I think the problem is that those in power are terribly corrupted. They're all stealing. They're a bunch of mafia. I think an overwhelmingly large percentage of the brown or coloured people are great people. I've got a lot of friends who are what they call coloured. The Indian people, I think they're enormously smart. I mean, we often have Indian guests on Loving Life TV, and their insights are just extraordinary. And I love the Indian people. That I really feel like, you know, a great affinity. And what we're talking about, or I'm talking about when we talk about these idiots who are running the country, we're talking about a tiny percentage of ANC who are just on the take. They're stealing, they're cleaning out, and I think that's what's destroying South Africa. Just as this tiny little so-called elite who are killing off what is South Africa. That's my position on the situation. I would love for the majority, the Indians, the coloureds, the whites, in particular, to work together, because I think if they actually forged an alliance, and you know, they could make South Africa a fantastic place as a group. And then of course with the majority of the black Africans who are good people, they're hardworking people, and we just got rid of this crap that's running in South Africa, I think that would change everything.
Scott, you are right, but I need to also explain to you that all communist revolutions in the whole world, that whenever people come to power, it is the radicals. It's a small group of radicals, and they're ruthless, and they are murderers, and they'll kill anybody, and they are absolutely ruthless. And so the problem is, when you get that small hardcore who have got power, and they've got people with weapons and people with money, that they will always try to stir things up. And they are, I will tell you that in my from my studies of history, that good black people who try to stand up against them will have to watch out, because they might just be killed outright. So be aware that these people will play dirty tricks, that they will lie to their own people. They'll lie to them. They'll say the whites did this, or the Indians did that, or so. They'll lie. They'll stir them up.
I want to tell you a joke. Okay, now, I hope I get this right. Okay, so look, Elle Macpherson she was a gorgeous, gorgeous woman, for those who are young, who don't remember Elle Macpherson. But Elle Macpherson, Pinocchio, and Superman are walking down the street, and they go past this building, and it says competition for the most beautiful woman in the world. So Elle Macpherson says, "Hey, I'm going to go and check this out." So she goes in, and a bit later she comes out and says, "Guess what? I won! And anyway, they're walking down the street a bit further, and then there's another building that says competition for the strongest man in the world. And Superman says, "I'm going to go and check this out." So he goes in, and a few minutes later he comes out and says, I won. Going a bit further down, and there's another building that says competition for the biggest liar in the world. And Pinocchio says, "I'm going to go in there. I'm a dead set ringer for this one." So Pinocchio goes inside, and a little bit later he comes out, and he looks at Superman and Elle Macpherson, and he says, "Who is Cyril Ramaphosa?"
Ah! Oh, that's brilliant. I never saw that coming. Excellent, excellent. Oh, God. I must tell you, I actually watched, there's one Indian Indian news agency that I watch whenever I'm looking for Asian stuff. And they also did a story on Cyril Ramaphosa and Pala Pala. And I must tell you, those Indians were telling the story of the buffaloes, yeah, and so forth, and they were telling it, and then the Indian news lady was saying, I'm not making these names up. These are real names. And she's saying like this, and she says, these things that we're talking about, it's a very, very strange story, and it's really hard to believe kind of thing. Because they just can't believe the bullshit and the errant garbage that's coming out of this. And you can see that they're seeing right through it. And these are Indians in India, and I was like, that's very good.
You know what's so exciting? And I'm going to wrap up on this comment. What's so exciting is that the general African population have started to see through the curtain. They've started to realize that the ANC are destroying their lives, and that's happening in the townships. It's happening all over. The ANC are becoming like pariah even amongst the people who used to support them so much.
Well, that's very good. Well, I think that maybe you should also consider that the future South Africa might not be fully South Africa. It might be chunks of this and chunks of that. And, you know, to give you an idea of the size of South Africa, do you know that South Africa, Ukraine is big. Yeah. By European standards, Ukraine is huge. Do you know that South Africa is twice the size of Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. South Africa is huge. Yeah.
South Africa is a huge piece of territory, and there's some freaking excellent stuff here.
Yeah. Mate, look, it's been fantastic talking to you. I've had the Chinese 70th anniversary of their military plane in the background, so that we've had something to look at while we're talking. But I'm going to wrap this up now. Is there anything, any message you'd like to give to people just in wrapping this up, Jan?
Okay, Scott, I apologize for the camera thing. I'll have to see, maybe some of the fiddling around here was the cause for the problem. So that's a real bummer. We'll be very careful next time, but so I apologize for that. With regard to my own stuff, I just want to say that there is a video that I put out not too long ago. It's called After Black Revolution Comes White Revolution. Some people might be interested in that video. And my website's africancrisis.info and historyreviewed.best, and we're going to have some very interesting stuff to talk about.
Absolutely.
And I appreciated your input and your thoughts, Scott. I think it's going to be, you know what, get rid of the ANC and then life is going to be very, very interesting, exciting, etc., no matter what.
They're so entrenched now at all levels of government that you've got to literally just clean out the house and start again. That's what you've got to do. And start with meritocracy. I mean, that without meritocracy, it's all over, Red Rover.
Scott, I have one final quote that is relevant.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the writings of King Frederick the Great of Prussia. And King Frederick the Great wrote huge amounts of stuff. But one of the points that King Frederick the Great made was he cited different European countries, and he pointed out that everything is top down, that it is the leader that determines the country.
Yeah.
So if you see when the French were at their best, when the Dutch were at their best, you'll see it's the leader. However, take a look at South Africa and you say, but we got the most disgusting, filthy bunch of criminals who were put in power here. Is it not simply the fact that we got garbage at the top and that's why everything's turned to garbage? It's really that simple. It's nothing more to it than that.
Right.
Okay, Scott.
Okay, thanks, Jan. And look, have a Merry Christmas, festive season, and have a good new year, and we'll be talking to you in 2023.
Yes, Scott, and same to you and your viewers. Mm. I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And 2023, expect more wildness and creepiness around the world.
Yeah.
All this garbage is starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
So have fun.
Well, I really do hope that secession happens in the Cape. All right, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you so much, Anne, and it's a shame that your camera wasn't working, but we got to see a lot of what's going on in China with their military displays while we were talking, so it wasn't too boring. When it came to the video side, the discussion was great. Jan, take care, and we'll chat to you soon.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
Ciao for
now. Bye.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.